and then verify that we're getting record levels?
We are getting record levels. So, I first met Stuart Gudnick 23 and a half years ago, and he has demonstrated his dedication to teaching, his dedication to Dharma, his dedication to practice over those 23 and a half years. Usually I don't sing the praises of someone I'm so intimately connected with, but lately Stuart's practice has reached a new level of intensity and clarity and purity that I'm pleased that you all will have the chance to share tonight. So, welcome, Stuart.
Thank you. Tonight is the beginning of the 9-day festival of Navaratri. I think it's Vashanta Navaratri, the Navaratri of spring. It's a 9-day Hindu festival in which the 9 manifestations of the Mother Goddess are worshipped. During the first 3 days, we worship Durga. And so we have various elements of Durga here to assist us this evening. This is a yantra, which is an abstract representation of the energy of the Mother Goddess Durga, Mother Goddess in the fiery manifestation. And we have two brass statues of the manifestation of Durga as Mahishamardini, which is the slayer of the buffalo demon, which is Durga in her clarity of passion and her warrior stance, vanquishing the uncontrolled passions of the material realm. So often we speak of a mother's love, and I'm happy enough to have my mother here this evening in the audience, but when we speak of the mother's love in the context of Durga, that can be a very, very powerful embrace. And so I hope this evening that our conversation can invoke Durga's love, because it gets to the essence of what the talk is about this evening. But before we start, I've found it a helpful when I've seen other speakers talk to begin with a short meditation. So I'd like us to start with just a 5-minute form of what we call self-observation, and that will be a practice that you do by just sitting comfortably. You can keep your back straight if that's comfortable. And while you do this practice, just put your attention on your body. Allow yourself to be aware of what feelings may be arising and what thoughts may be arising. And as you see these things, you don't have to do anything with them except simply acknowledge them and let them pass. So this is self-observation. We're not trying to judge. We're not trying to identify or categorize. We simply are trying to see what arises in our field of consciousness and to hold a space of silent witness as these phenomena present themselves. So let's begin. I should mention, as you do this in our tradition, you can just let your eye, your glance, or your eyes rest about a 45-degree angle in front of you, but keep them open. It helps to not be overwhelmed by the interior manifestation if we have some sensory input coming in at the same time. Brick. And now, since our topic tonight is the topic of love not hiding, we're going to do one more extension to this meditation, which is the Tayu practice of co-meditation. So I'd like you to pick a partner, so just turn to whoever's next to you, and you'll work with someone here. And simply turn to your partner, and for the next few minutes, take that same meditative attention that you cultivated for looking at what was arising within yourself, and look into the eyes of your partner, and simply put your meditative attention on your partner. Your face should be neutral while you do this. You just simply maintain eye contact and try to put as much attention on your partner as possible so that there isn't much attention left over for your own thoughts. Everyone have a partner? Can you turn around? Here. Right, begin. And break. That's right. The fiery love of Durga. So, the title of the talk is Love Does Not Hide. And one of the premises in this, in the write-up, was to draw a distinction between what often passes for love in the kind of common discourse and what our sort of early experiences of love are, and to distinguish that from a larger sense of love, something we might call spiritual love. So in the common vernacular, we talk about loving people, we talk about loving things, loving food, loving particular wines or particular teas. We talk about loving people. Some of our earliest experiences of love are these passionate crushes that we have on people in our early years, or sometimes not so early years, when we're taken and all we can think about is the object of our desires. And so most of us have this idea of love being in that domain. And we can refine that concept. We can make the things that we are attracted to more sophisticated, and we can refine the expressions and the manifestations of this kind of love. In fact, we can channel much of that passionate energy into things like music or art. We can try ever so harder to attract the attention of our beloved. And all of what we're doing, though, is a variation on a similar theme, which is that we are looking for something outside of ourselves to complete ourselves in a way. If I just have that relationship, then I will be complete. Or if I just have that glass of wine, my evening will be complete. Or if I just smoke that joint, or whatever manifestation it takes. But often we feel this most acutely in our romantic attachments, because the idea of the other, the idea of the person that we may be entranced by completing us, becomes a very, very, very powerful force. And sometimes we find ourselves doing interesting things we wouldn't do in other contexts in service of this desire energy. And so that seeking, that grasping outward is how we might best characterize the sense of conventional love. You might call it organic love, because it's love that arises in deep connection with the functioning of the body. You know, our hormones get activated. Our feeling centers will produce rapid heartbeats. You know, we're looking for this culmination, this excitement. And our sexual energy gets tied up into that as well. So this becomes very powerful, because there's this urge or this energy for completion that we're constantly being responding to. So this kind of sense of love has a quality of seeking or grasping for something outside of ourselves. And one of the problems with this is that will make the claim, and I'll certainly make the claim from a spiritual perspective, that that kind of grasping ultimately is doomed to dissatisfaction, because that kind of grasping for completion outside of ourselves constantly focuses our attention on the object, constantly focuses us outward, and reifies the illusion that if we just grab something outside of ourselves, that that will complete us and that will make us whole. And so it's this underlying current of lack of wholeness, or this underlying sense of incompleteness, that is driving this outward grasping for completion. And you can see, I mean, as I speak of this even logically, you can see that action can never satisfy itself, because the source of the problem, or the source of the need, is in a completely opposite direction than the where we're trying to find that solution. And so conventional love is a sort of a trap in a way. And I don't mean to belittle it, because when I refer to organic love, our bodies are evolved to be effective and wonderful instruments of expressing that kind of love. So the love we have for our sexual lovers, the love we have for children, or the love we have for parents or brothers or family or friends, all has a quality of that validation and completeness with something outside of ourselves. And it's not a problem in one sense. It's just that at a deeper level, there's an incompleteness that can never be solved with that kind of expression, or with that kind of seeking. So even describing things in this way begs the question, okay, well, if that's conventional love, then what is the alternative? What is the antidote, or what is the possibility for addressing this inward sense of incompletion? So it's an easy thing to say, and this is a difficult area, because it's very easy to be glib. It's very easy to throw out a bunch of words that give us pat definitions for what this must mean. And I don't want to give in to that lure just yet anyway, because it's all too easy to start to talk about spiritual love. It's all too easy to kind of throw out words of selfless love, or words of unconditional love, and we hear that all the time. But I don't want to do that just yet, because our spiritual tradition is grounded in the fourth way tradition, and the fourth way is very reserved about talking about love. It's reserved about it, I think, not because it's a heartless tradition, which has sometimes been accused of, but because there's a sense of not wanting to make the subject too easy. We don't want to sort of lay everything out at an intellectual level, because that ultimately will cause evaporation of that which we're actually seeking to understand. So in a way, it's necessary for us to cultivate the conditions by which we can become infused with an understanding of what this other kind of love might be. And so I want to start by maybe talking, rather than talking with definitions about what it is, I'd like to talk about what some of the qualities might be that we might experience about with this kind of love. So one quality that I've found has been a very useful gate, very useful guide to cultivating an understanding of this subject, is the topic of vulnerability. So our egoic structures, our personalities, are very good at keeping us from being vulnerable. Our egos, in fact, it can be argued, I think quite well, are these fantastic psychological creations to, in fact, ensure that we aren't vulnerable, certainly at an emotional level, and even to a large degree at a physical level. We gain skills, we gain personality characteristics that allow us to deflect and to defend against even some of the most rudimentary attacks. Because as children, when we have no defenses, we're sometimes shocked by the abruptness of the universe. And in that shock, we have to pull in and have to do something to keep the pain from overwhelming us. And so that something is to begin to create what we call in our tradition buffers or defenses that allow us to contextualize our experience and contextualize the situation and to sort of keep the raw pain that we experienced from overwhelming us. So vulnerability seems to be a key element of this subject. In my own experience, in my own practice, one of the hardest aspects of practice is to allow myself to be vulnerable, to allow myself to be touched. And I warrant that that's one of the biggest challenges for anyone engaging in spiritual work, to truly allow oneself to be affected by the universe, to allow the universe in, as opposed to us going out to grab a piece of the universe. And that's a very difficult thing. I have found that in doing a certain kind of work on ourselves, which we'll talk about in as we proceed, that it's possible to relax, or a more accurate word for our emotional experience is to surrender. Surrender to our lives, surrender to what's outside of ourselves, to allow ourselves to be touched, to be affected by what is coming into us. But this is very, very difficult. It's a very difficult thing to do because our defenses are so damn good, and they're so fast, that it really does take a kind of practice to begin to slow down the action of the defenses so that we can actually have the possibility, even remote possibility, of laying down the machine to allow something in. And so part of our practice and part of our work, our spiritual work, is to bring our attention, or to turn our attention in a different direction than this direction I was talking about earlier. So whereas in conventional lives our direction is completely outwardly focused, when we begin to work along a spiritual path, as I think all of you in this room know, there's some sense or some notion of bringing your attention inward. And one of the things that we do when we begin to work in the heart space is to bring our attention inward and to become aware of the high degree of defenses that we have operating, the defenses that keep us from being touched. And in the course of practice, it becomes possible to create an opening, to allow the universe to touch us, to allow the universe in, to allow other people in. So the co-meditation practice we did is a good example of one such way of doing that, because what we try to do with that practice is both give ourselves an opportunity to see the arising of defenses, because particularly when you're doing it with a stranger or someone that you don't know well, there's all sorts of things that will come up at an emotional level that will give us a sense of what I'm talking about here. But at the same time, there's something else that becomes possible when we have practice with co-meditation, where we can relax a little bit into that space. We have the possibility of actually putting attention on another and allowing another to put attention on us in a way that opens. It opens our hearts. It allows us it cultivates a willingness to see, truly see another, and to allow ourselves to be seen. And so that's an aspect of this love with a capital L that I'm sort of circling around now, is the willingness to see and the willingness to be seen. So the willingness to see has two sides of it. The first side in our practice is our willingness to see ourselves. So beyond just the mechanical definition of laying down our defenses, which sounds like an engineer talking, you know, if I just lay down the defenses and the gates will be open and everything will be wonderful. There's a more fundamental matter, and that's the matter of us being willing to look at ourselves. So when we turn our attention towards ourselves, it's not uncommon to have an experience not unlike squirming, where there are aspects of ourselves we actually don't want to look at, or aspects of ourselves we haven't liked, aspects of ourselves we're not comfortable with, or aspects of ourselves that we have conveniently sort of shunted to the side and pretended don't exist. But for us to come into this love with a capital L, it becomes imperative that we're willing to look at ourselves entirely, look at ourselves clearly, look at ourselves honestly, and look at ourselves without judgment. And that, again, I run the danger of sounding glib here, because this is no small thing. This is no small task we're talking about. It's very easy to say, look at yourself without judgment. But I can tell you from years of practice that it's a very, very challenging thing, because it's an intimate process. It's an intimate process of seeing at corners of ourselves that we have spent lifetimes trying to hide. But it's a willingness that is necessary for us to proceed in this work, to see, to be willing to put attention on ourselves, to be willing to look at ourselves objectively. It requires an intuition. It requires a knowing that's at a deeper level, and that knowing is that we're okay. And that, when one begins one's practice, usually isn't accessible. Often we have to have it demonstrated. So, for instance, one of the functions of a spiritual teacher is to put attention on us so that someone can demonstrate unqualifiedly that they are willing to behold the real parts of ourselves, not the defenses. And in fact, a good spiritual teacher will put attention in such a way that there's little room for the defenses. In fact, the defenses may be greeted with the fiery passion that Durga reserves for her most recalcitrant subjects. And yet, the attention that a teacher can place on someone when they're being themselves is the sweetest, most exquisite attention that we might ever have experienced up to that point. Because it's the attention of full acceptance. It's the attention of full touching. It's a way of feeling like one is completely, absolutely seen for what and who one is. Now, that's a demonstration, and that's not a complete picture, because a teacher operating in that capacity is giving a demonstration to us that we can actually bring that kind of attention to ourselves. This is why it's difficult, and why in our tradition we adopt a teacher-student model, because getting that kind of demonstration is important, because coming to practice, coming to spiritual work in a out of just ordinary life, we don't have that many demonstrations of that kind of complete acceptance. If we're lucky, if we're very lucky, then our lives started out that way, with our mothers and our fathers giving us that kind of attention when we were babies. But as we get older and develop personalities and begin to sort of struggle in a conventional human sense, that attention isn't necessarily always available. And so it's so it's up to us to recognize it again and to recreate it for ourselves in our work. So when we can look at ourselves with the openness and the acceptance, the complete acceptance, the spaciousness that a spiritual teacher might reserve for us, when we can truly begin to internalize that way of turning our attention in towards ourselves, then we begin to experience a different relationship to our world. Something truly does shift in that change, because when you can see yourself and when you're willing to look at yourself that clearly, then that within us which feels incomplete begins to recognize that the source for its completion is going within, as opposed to reaching without for that completion. And when that happens, it doesn't mean that overnight we become transformed into a radiant bodhisattva that has, you know, love and attention available for everybody, but we actually take a step in that direction. Because when we're willing to look at ourselves truly, when we're willing to behold ourselves truly, we become able to behold others truly. Up until that time, what we're doing is some sort of odd mixture of grasping, possibly a little bit of light shining through the cracks, but it's often a conditional kind of attention. We're trying to validate something in ourselves and the attention that we reserve for others. But when we can look at ourselves truly and see ourselves and behold ourselves and hold ourselves without judgment, that's not to say that we're perfect or that we're not, you know, idiots in one sense or another sense and we don't have more work to do, but when we're willing to contain ourselves in our idiocy, then we're able to contain others in their idiocy. And what we are able to then do is to connect with others in a way that isn't available in the conventional small L. Then words like unconditional begin to actually have some experiential dimension as opposed to an intellectual definition. Because we've made this kind of shift. We've made this kind of turning towards ourselves. And paradoxically, when we turn towards ourselves and begin to hold ourselves as beings, then we are able to turn towards the rest of the universe. And in fact, our claim is that you can't help but turn towards the rest of the universe. And that's the point at which love can no longer hide. Because when we are able to provide that kind of attention, that unqualified attention, that simple presence of attention, which you get a little bit of taste of when you do the co-meditation practice here, when we're able to apply that to ourselves, we necessarily are able to apply it to the rest of the universe. And then we're able to truly allow ourselves to be open to the universe. And in the sense that we do take the step towards being something of a bodhisattva, our hearts have the possibility of opening such that that attention simply radiates out all the time. That becomes the natural state of our existence. That becomes the natural condition of our being. Up until that time, when our center of gravity is in the kind of grasping outward for completion, the quality of our attention for the rest of the universe is highly subjective, highly conditioned by situations. But when we're able to offer this unqualified attention for the rest of the creation by virtue of having offered it for ourselves, then our attention and our love takes on an objective quality. So maybe better than love with a capital L, what we could call this is objective love, because it is beingness beholding beingness, beingness willing to hold and to touch and to be touched by beingness. And in a sense, then, that's all we find there is in the universe. It's beingness expressing itself. But again, it sounds, the words are easy, but the actual experience of that is very, very challenging to actually embody. And so that's why I'm trying to be very careful about how we talk about this. I'll say one more thing before we take some questions, and that's that this sense of vulnerability is an interesting one, because when we open ourselves in this way, we become very vulnerable. We can be hurt. The pain isn't the same as the kind of negating pain that we experience as children that cause us to reflexively create the psychological armor of the ego. But it is a real pain, because when being beholds being, that's infinite intimacy. It's like the depth of that has no end. It's the ultimate personal intimacy that we experience when we open our hearts. But that can come with profound pain, because when others turn away, we feel that. And in fact, not long ago, I had a rather shocking experience along these lines, in that in some work we were doing at Tayu, I had occasion to be able to experience and actually invite in that sense of vulnerability in work I was doing with someone. And it took on an archetypical dimension, in that I found I was sobbing uncontrollably in the face of this sense of rejection, or this sense of loss that I was feeling. And as that worked on me throughout the day, I had just a little bit of an insight. I wouldn't call it a complete overwhelming, you know, grabbing it fully, but it began to give me the sense of, when I've heard of the teachers like Lee Loswick or George Gurdjieff, for that matter, speaking about the suffering of God. You know, that was Gurdjieff's question. That was his question that he took as sort of a central aim for his self-exploration. Does God suffer? I realized that God, the totality of beingness, indeed does suffer, and it suffers that very loss I was feeling when each of us turns our attention away. So when we turn our attention outward in this grasping way, that does induce a suffering in being. And that was an abstraction to me before, but I'm telling you this now to sort of raise the stakes on the urgency of each of your own work, because if you want to relieve God of God's suffering, then it's time to bring your attention back to being, as opposed to your attention being locked on form. So at this point, I'd like to hear from you all if you have questions or reflections on what we've been talking about. Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit more about what it means to see somebody in this specific sense and they're using that?
Yeah, I'd say that the way I would start with that is, let me start with what it means to see ourselves. So I can give a definition in the context of work on ourselves, which is that we as fields of consciousness, we as embodied being, have various things that impinge on our field of consciousness. And if we are willing to see those things clearly and not defend against them, then we can see objectively what is arising. When we see what feelings arise in connection with which thoughts, or which feelings arise in connection with which spasms of the muscles, when we see the organism as simply an objective interconnection of very complex energies, we can see that, and we can see that what arises in this organism is not who we are. It's simply something that we experience. And so that's a kind of objective seeing, that there's no reason not to look at a particular thing because we are identified with it. Normally, when we begin this work, we're identified. We have a projection of, oh, if I'm doing that, that's bad. Or, gee, I never do that, or I shouldn't do that, or, you know, I'm an idiot for doing that. And when we project in that way, we sort of disrupt or distort what we're seeing. So looking at ourselves in an objective way simply means being able to witness without reaction the manifestation of our organism. So that quality of non-reactivity then, when it's turned to another, is more of the same, really, because in that space, with that kind of witnessing, we're able to see the manifestations of another being. We're able to see the thoughts that arise. We're able to see the feelings that are radiating from the body, and we can see how the body is being held. And so that's seeing someone objectively. However, there's another step as well, because when we don't react to another in that way, when we can drop the projections we have, the expectations we have, then it's possible to actually see the being of another. See that in you, which is the same as that in me. And to share that exquisite paradox of unity and duality sort of intertwined together, so that you and I are one, and yet you and I are embodied separately. And when you see the being at that level, that just causes the heart center to expand and to radiate. And that is the gift of true seeing. It's that expansive sharing of the mutual recognition of beingness and the mutual recognition of identity and duality in one.
Yes, you brought up a point tonight about vulnerability, and it's that it was a psychological position, posture that you take, that is, that there's the possibility of being hurt.
Mm-hmm.
But because our defense mechanisms have been removed, so we can't fight fire back. So the point I'm seeing here is that you're talking about love hiding. When I was raised with my mother and father, in my own relationships and people around me, I noticed when fellow humans couple up, they start off in this, what I would call, a kind of a synthetic ecstasy, that their love is going to last forever. You know, and I felt that. It felt like that. And then there's a kind of entropy that takes over, and I came up with an expression called the bastard bitch interlocking complex, where you get to a point where there's fierce fighting and a lot of negativity. I remember my mother saying, never get between couples that are doing that, because it's kind of like the bell curve thing going on. And they're working through something. And at that point, that's where I felt what you're saying, the love that they have. I'm thinking, you feel that it's hiding, it's hidden, even though this violence is going on. And it's regenerating, because what happens, it's on the upswing. All of a sudden, like my mother used to say, I'm only staying together with your father because of you kids. Otherwise, I'd be long gone. So there'd be something that keeps them together. And they go through it, and all of a sudden, they're back in love again. You know, I mean, you could hear the mattress going all night long. You know, it's just like they're totally in love again. And then, it's back down into this valley of fatigue again, where they're battling again, and then it goes back up again. So, do I see here that... Does the love, when it's love, you know, the organic love, I'm not talking about a, you know, a higher love of some sort of spiritual, is the love continuous, but it's covered by this cloud of this process, or is it really absent, and it has to be found again?
I guess the way that what comes up for me about that is when you're talking about organic love, to... maybe I'll give a nod to our friend R.J. Stewart, who will be here tomorrow night, because he uses very archetypical examples for this. But it's like the phases of the moon. Sometimes the moon is full, sometimes the moon is new, sometimes it's somewhere in between. And there's this constant cycle that's going on. And so one of the characteristics of organic love is that it's very lunar, in the sense that it's has phases and it's constantly changing because it's of and part of the phenomenal world that's constantly changing, and it's conditioned by the phenomenal world that's constantly changing. So in that sense, again, I don't mean, and you shouldn't mistake me for saying by saying that that's bad or anything. It simply is what it is. It's a sort of has a cyclic nature to it, and there's the embrace, and there's the rejection, and the embrace again, and that's just the natural characteristic of that kind of expression. It's tied together in part by the sexual energy or the Shakti energy, which is characteristic of love on various levels. But when we're talking about this love of being and this being, this expansiveness of being, I would call that more solar, in the sense that it is, no matter what angle you look at it from, it's radiating outward. And so it's a different, it's simply a different expression. And sometimes it's confusing because there's some very exquisite expressions of love in organic love, just in the sense that the light of the moon is a reflection of the light of the sun. And so in that sense, there, you know, no harm, no foul. It's simply a particular phenomena, and it's conditioned by the changing nature of the phenomenal world.
So when you say that the moon can reflect the sun, would you say that the fighting and the bickering that might go on in a love couple could be a form of love then? It's just that it's
certainly
reflective.
It's not exclusive of it.
So love doesn't have to be these warm, fuzzy feelings. It could be blasting each other with, like, this is what you are. This
is the first day of Navaratri, and Durga is in ascendancy right now. Durga's love is fierce and fiery and blows apart pretension. So love, in this sense we're talking about, in terms of being, to being love, can manifest as actually very dramatic. When we invoke the goddess in that way, we sometimes we get surprised by the results. And yet, in the end, it's the quality of that kind of love, the quality of this love of being, is an affirmation of our beingness and a dissolution of our defenses. Yeah.
I have a question. Do you feel like the higher love that you're speaking of is solar? Did I understand you correctly?
Yeah, it's a term I use for.
Okay.
I wouldn't get too caught up in that, but
it's so fascinating to me because I feel like everything in life is. It's a continuous cycle of contraction and expansion, and that's what I feel like our friend was talking about, is just expansion and contraction. And the cycles of relationship and career and bank accounts and everything is just mm-hmm. that. So in a solar, looking at higher love as solar love, do you still feel like, I mean, I understand that in order to acknowledge the expansion or light, you have to acknowledge darkness. So in this higher level of love, what do you see that those cycles as? Is my question making sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, the way I'd respond to that is that the in this love of being, in this unqualified attention that we can place on our lives, ourselves, the people in our lives, our jobs, even. It's possible to do it even in our jobs. We can be aware of the cyclic nature of the phenomenal world, and yet that doesn't have to impinge on what we experience. In other words, this quote-unquote higher love, or this solar love, if you will, it can contain the cyclic nature of our phenomenal lives, so that, you know, we have ups and downs, we may even have emotional expressions of happiness and sadness that arise and pass in our organisms, but there's something stable and real that contains all of that, that we are continuously in touch with. And then that cyclic nature of life is, can be beheld, it can be worked with, it can be enjoyed, but it's not something that changes or impinges on that which contains it.
The foundation.
Right.
Right. So it's perspective. It's ultimately seeing those cycles from a different perspective.
In a way. The only reason that I hesitate with the word perspective is that perspective, the way that the word is used, has a kind of an intellectual or a mediated aspect. If I have a perspective on something, then I have a way of sort of framing it. So the word that we tend to use in our own work is presence. And presence has sort of a substantial or energetic quality, where if I attain to greater presence, then my being is able to encompass more of the phenomenal. I'm able to be present to more of our endlessness. And in that sense, it's not a perspective, because it's the very nature of my being that is effecting this containing.
I see. Thank you.
Thank you.
I had one other thought, just that really struck me as you were speaking about vulnerability, and I feel like it's terrifying in this culture for people to allow themselves to be vulnerable, and I've seen it more often on when people are on their deathbed. That they're not in control anymore, and they are seeing and showing their truest selves. And I just was struck by what you were saying and had that thought about death. And I also feel like as a culture we're terrified of death. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that that disconnect throughout our lives is adding to the fear of death.
That's a very interesting point, and I appreciate you bringing up the vulnerability at the deathbed. I'm immediately taken to an experience that my family had a couple of years ago when my father died, and some of the sweetest, most poignant memories I have is that complete vulnerability and acceptance in his face and in his eyes in the impending days before his death. And yet it was a very beautiful situation. It really lost, didn't enter into it, because of that sweet, real, open quality that was present there. And I think your point's right, that the very invincibility of certainly the American psyche is definitely tied up with our terror of death.
We have our work cut out for us,
yeah.
Don't we?
Yeah, as a culture, we're very individualistic, and you know that makes this a particularly challenging issue for us. I mean, it's not that cultures that are more embracing of death tend to be more, you know, individuals, even if they're polarized male and female in their culture, they tend to be more open-hearted, and that's a lovely thing. It doesn't mean they don't have other spiritual issues that they have to contend with, but the American issue, I think, is right on with what you're saying. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm. Yeah.
Thanks, Tori. Boy, so much going on. A favorite line of mine is guarding vulnerability with greater vulnerability. Is probing to the roots of reason, is probing to the roots of art and form and joy and pain and art again. We have a strange relationship with vulnerability, because we have a strange relationship with fear, I think, and not accepting it as the teacher that it is. And when we do, then its mask kind of falls away. But I often wonder if fear isn't love in disguise, and it's not calling us. But fear forces us to look at whether we're courageous or not, and it gives us an opportunity to try our courage. So seeing, if we see it out there as something we want to find out there, we're going to find out the truth by doing it, by going after it anyway. That we're not equal to that if we're not equal to it.
Well, ideally that's the case. Sometimes we have to hit our heads against the same wall for a long time before we can take that lesson. But I want to speak to the point you said about vulnerability being guarded by a greater vulnerability. And one of the things, just experientially, that about vulnerability that I find paradoxical is that is the great strength there is in being completely vulnerable. And that gets to this question of this what we were talking about with presence, because we have to be able to have sort of the presence to contain our vulnerability so that we're not washed away by it. But then with that presence, we can be exquisitely vulnerable and sensitive to the universe and the actions of the universe. And that may entail pain, but it's an exquisite pain. When I was describing this situation from a couple weeks ago of feeling this deep vulnerability, there was strangely great joy with that. Joy at being able to be touched so deeply as I was feeling myself touched, because most of the time when we're invulnerable, you know, it's like the universe, you know, knocks on our shell. And it's not particularly interesting because experientially we feel numb at the heart level. But when you can actually open your heart and allow yourself to be touched, there may be pain, but it's exquisite because we are feeling ourselves as the barrier, the boundary between us and the universe has sort of evaporated, and we are being touched. We're being touched by God. We're being touched by the universe. And that's a sweet, sweet vulnerability, and strangely it's a profoundly strong place when we can enter into that consciously, because it is like the root of being. We're able to stand in the root of being and to be touched.
It's almost like a gateway, and if you stay on the one side of it, you never get a chance to step through to the other side.
Yes.
Well, vulnerability, my experience has been that to be vulnerable, you have to be willing to accept your pain.
Mm-hmm.
I lost a daughter and I lost a son, which is not the norm in life. And I found myself being strong when I had to learn to do was to be weak and cry and feel my grief. Mm-hmm. And then it dawned on me that I loved them no less than death than I did in life. It didn't change.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that changed was they weren't here in the body. But the love was still there. So that allowed me the vulnerability to feel my pain. I still cry. I still miss them.
Yeah.
But the true experience is the love doesn't die. It just is.
Yeah, thank you. That's so well put. That's the paradox of vulnerability and objective love. The love can't go away.
It can't go away
because it's like part of the infrastructure of the universe.
Right.
But we can still feel.
We can feel it.
And that's the
that feeling is the vulnerability part.
Right. And I think that's a uniquely human experience. I was reading recently a book by Ali Lazowick, a Baal Sufi teacher that we know, some of you may know, great teacher, impeccable spiritual practitioner. This was an early book of his, but it was called The Only Grace is Loving God. And one of the things that he articulated in that book was that as humans, we have the possibility of loving God as in separation. That the highest possibility for an embodied human is to love God as a separate being, which is different than the mode of relationship of everything is consciousness. To know yourself as one with God, to know yourself as beingness, is different. When that will have with us when our bodies fall away. That's the nature of our being. But to love God, to truly love God, to open our hearts to the phenomenal realm, that's something that we only get in this lifetime. We only get it in these bodies. You know, this isn't about getting rid of the body or overcoming the body. It's about inhabiting the body so fully that we can experience that wonderful, wonderful paradox of being embodied and yet being at one, just like we were talking about. To love the universe as in separation and yet simultaneously to know no separation is the paradox that is the human potential. And it goes away when the body dies. You know, maybe we'll take another birth, maybe we will ascend to some other plane of beingness, but the human condition is the condition of opening the heart to the phenomenal and being touched intimately at the same time that we can know at a level of being the unity.
And with the fear of the parents that are fighting, the fear, they're not fighting, they fear they're going to lose the other. That's fear.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be nice if all that fear could just fall away and we could just embody the true love that's between us without all the artifice and the barriers and the obstructions we put between ourselves?
Right. But it's something that we can consciously work with. And the wonderful, you know, the good news, if you will, of spiritual practices, there are paths that can allow us to create or cultivate the conditions where that falling away can take place. And it's not even falling away in a sense, because even that's sort of setting ourselves at odds with the fear that we feel. It's more embracing it. Durga's embrace. You know, you contain it with your presence. When you contain it with your presence, that fear can be there. But in the light and heat of that solar radiation, it too can grow, and it too can change, and it too can evolve, such that it becomes something different. Something that might be more along the lines of what we're talking about, of the feeling of vulnerability. For me to have felt the vulnerability I was describing earlier, where I was truly in pain and sobbing because of a sense of loss, I had to be an individual human. You don't get that if everything is consciousness.
I was not talking about blending and losing barriers. I was talking about retaining the sense of selfness and at the same time letting go of what stands between us.
Yeah. Being willing to look, in a
exactly.
sense.
Letting being go. Willing to be
yeah.
aware.
Right. And that's what practice
and
is.
Be individual humans.
Right. And it's available to us. It takes work. I mean, it takes work not in a drudgery sense. It sort of takes, like any habit, it takes constant reification or constant reminding. And when we do that, though, nothing can stop us. If our heart is pure, truly nothing can stop us in that, in this kind of pursuit.
But literally, like Durga, taking fear as the small dark being and sitting on it,
yeah.
squashing it.
Yeah, that's the poor little Mahisha Mardini down
yeah.
here, which until Durga's spear is running it through, is the great demon, the great
yeah.
buffalo demon. Because our fears look so big until we actually are willing to behold them and to embrace them and hold them. Yeah. Thank you.
you're one of them. I have a game that I play with myself of taking words, and actually it goes with the Kabbalah, of taking each letter and making a word, make a sentence.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the ones that I came up with was life's only viable experience. It's the only thing that can stand alone. Life's only viable experience is love.
Mm.
You don't have to nurture it. You don't have to feed it. It just is.
Thank you.
It's a viable experience.
It's a viable experience. It's
viable.
The very essence of life.
It lives without the womb.
Yeah. Thank you. How are we doing on
YouTube?
Oh, still have time.
Any tools?
Tools. Yeah, there are tools for this that we did a little taste of these practices. The foundational tool that we use to begin to set the stage is the tool of self-observation. And that's a quality of consciousness that is available to us in that tends to be latent in ordinary processing or experiential processing, but we cultivate it and begin to exercise it. And it's the quality of consciousness that can be aware of something without judging it, or without naming it, or without moving toward it or away from it, or without tensing and contracting. So that kind of awareness, that kind of what we call observer awareness, is the what we begin to cultivate in our practice so that we can turn our attention towards ourselves from a place of non-reactivity. So we begin to see the functioning of our mental space, our physical space, and ultimately our emotional space, and to see how each of those spaces interact. And that action practiced, you know, on an ongoing basis actually cultivates this thing I was calling presence. It cultivates the awareness to contain the manifestations of our being. In the process of doing that, we find where some of the deep habit patterns are. And the deep habit patterns are those things that don't melt away so quickly. And that may require different orders of work. And there are practices and techniques often tuned to an individual's particular situation that arise to work with those kinds of things. But at the beginning, it's self-observation. And then the other practices that are particularly relevant to the topic tonight is the co-meditation that we were doing. There's a lot of different forms of co-meditation. We just did a very basic form, but all of those forms share the utilization of engagement with another, opening ourselves to another as a vehicle for deepening our presence. And so when we can both look at ourselves with self-observation and look at another objectively, then we begin to grow a quality of a presence that isn't impacted by these kinds of things. And that's where the possibilities that we've been talking about start. But as I said, you know, when one actually gets into this work more deeply, particularly in the intimate context of like working closely with a teacher whose job it is to basically see deeply into all the things that are going on within one, it can, you know, we all run up against habit patterns that are more resilient, and it sometimes takes creative work to demonstrate to ourselves that we need not even be identified with those particular habit patterns. And so in that way, over time, we remove the barriers, we remove the obstacles that keep us from both looking at ourselves and looking at others purely and objectively, such that our hearts necessarily open. Thank you.
Maybe you could mention some of the contents.
Question.
No.
What if you sat and looked into a mirror for quite a period of time as a tool of self-observation. Would you see something different than the sort of picture of yourself that you have as you look into a mirror?
Well, there are certainly practices where you can look into a mirror and shift the habitual experience of looking at this reflection of ourselves looking back. It's a different practice than co-meditation, because the co-meditation practice has a uncontrolled element there, because there's someone else. And it's that quality of someone else that's not sort of directly in our control that makes the co-meditation a ground for a lot of spontaneity that may not be available in other solitary practices.
Do you think you're doing self-observation when you do co-meditation, because you're busy observing the other?
Mm-hmm.
And you more or less lose touch with what you are thinking or being? Or
yeah. So when we do the practice, there's various stages of it, but one stage, in the beginning stage, is to cultivate being both aware of what's going on within oneself and put attention on the other person. And then it's possible to put more attention on the other person, but that often is because we don't have things in ourselves that are calling attention to themselves as much as we deepen in that practice.
Tonight you did say to put all of your attention on the other person and not
right.
leaving room for thoughts and all
right.
of that, which gave kind of a different experience than other times here when I've done co-meditation little exercises, because it was kind of like I was blank and I was seeing just kind of, it was like looking in a mirror but seeing a different set of eyes.
Mm-hmm.
But there was it wasn't as much, it didn't involve like opening the heart as much as if maybe it had been to, let something open between the two of you. I don't know, I just think the directions made it a little different.
I thought it was just trying to experience the other person. Just to
right.
Got out of our co-meditation.
Because I know a lot of times we see other people, even say a spouse or someone you're really familiar with, you don't really see them.
Right.
But somehow the veil parts. Oh my goodness, you're another human being right here with me. It's almost kind of frightening.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I think with the co-meditation practice, when we do it a lot, you get to experience the kind of the full range. Because in one sense, what you're describing, when we put attention on another and there's a lot of stuff coming up internally, that's often how we end up projecting onto someone else. So we use that instruction sometimes as a way to try to get beyond the projecting. But you can try it both ways, because it's also important to see what happens within ourselves in connection with another, because that's important information. Thank you. So what was your...
Where are the contexts where people can experience these tools?
Oh, okay. I was trying to figure out what you were leading me on to say. So yeah, no, it wasn't. Sorry.
And thank you for sharing so much about vulnerability. That's just really important.
Thank you. Yeah, definitely. So the context that Rob was talking about is what Tai Yu Center does in terms of our work. We have study groups. We have a regular meeting group that meets in at Many Rivers on most Tuesday nights, except the fourth Tuesday night. Right? And that's a place where we explore some of these ideas and practices on an ongoing basis, with discussion, with actual practices, with sometimes darshan and feedback. We have twice a month a Sunday meditation in South Sebastopol at our center, and we have a co-meditation workshop once a month where we actually spend a day going through systematically some of the different forms of co-meditation, which is a that's actually a great space for exploring what we've been talking about, and exploring both co-meditation in various forms and being in a context where it's safe to open in ways that we don't often get. Context where people can look at each other and see each other without having to guard against being judged. And then the work of the Tayu Center itself on an ongoing basis is a functional spiritual school, in that there are teachers, students, and much of what is transmitted in a spiritual context happens sometimes between the formal activities. It's hanging out in the context of a place where people are doing this kind of work that gives rise to the possibility of different habits and different patterns of possibilities to emerge. Did I miss the context?
That's good.
Good. Yes, sir.
Could you finish off by saying a little bit more about this deity that started its influence today? You know, what would be the significance for the people sitting in this room and knowing why it starts today? What can we grasp for?
I could. I could, but the way I'll respond to that is I'll give an example of. In honor of our speaker tomorrow night, R.J. Stewart, he has a tarot deck called the Merlin Tarot Deck. So we got ourselves a copy of it, and we're exploring doing tarot readings. And with anything like this, anything I say is bullshit. However, if you want to understand what this energy is about and what this symbol is about, just reflect on the energy that we shared this evening. There is a quality of energy in this space, and that will give you a truer guide to Durga than any words that I could give you. Because it was the energy, the fiery energy of the mother goddess embracing us all. And so it was actually rather sweet tonight. I can assure you that other times she's not so sweet.
There was somebody having a truck fire out here and a fire engine for most of your talk.
Oh, excellent. Well, then Durga was alive and well.
The fire
pit. Well, then we were fortunate that the fire was out there, not in here. So we that's because we invoked a fire of a different kind.
Mm-hmm.
Are we good time? Any last questions or comments?
Wouldn't that fire be that it's spoken of so many times in mystical teachings, the fire that doesn't burn, that's your own passion. There is a passion, there is a fire to it, but it doesn't burn.
Right.
It doesn't consume anything.
That's a perfect note to end on. I couldn't have said it better myself. The fire that doesn't burn. So thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.